Okay. After Wolfgang, Catalyst Talk yesterday, where you reported on the formation of a condensate of adiabatic compression and sound at finite temperature, I'd like to report on two other recent developments in this MIT group: optical confinement of the Bose-Einstein condensate and observation of Feldspath resonances. Here's a list of people which were involved. I only like to point out that Michael Andrews, which is in the audience, had this Feldspath resonance project as a final PhD project. Well, the motivation for building up an optical trap for a condensate are pretty obvious. The optical trap is able to confine all spin states, all hyperfine sublevels, and it works in arbitrary magnetic external bias field. So in some sense, it opens up two new dimensions of experimental freedom. The optical dipole trap is able to trap strong field-seeking states or liquid-seeking states at field values where they become strong field-seeking. Multi-component condensates with lots of spin dynamics are accessible experimentally. And also you can think of some applications guiding the atoms, building optical tweezers and things like that. The major motivation, however, for our optical dipole trap was to observe Feldspath resonances. These resonances were theoretically predicted a few years ago by the Perhar group. And they pointed already out that Feldspath resonances should allow to get control over the scattering lengths, because Feldspath resonances change the scattering length, the S-wave scattering length. But the optical trap is just a different approach to form a confining potential. The basic process is the AC Stark shift. It depends on the intensity of a light field, which is in frequency detuned from a fundamental transition in the atom. So it depends on the intensity and on the detuning. And we tried first with the most simple setup, namely just a single focused Gaussian beam. So the potential that is created by such a light field is Gaussian, essentially. But if we restrict ourselves to the bottom, kind of the bottom of this Gaussian potential, we can approximate this potential by a parabola. So it's just another a parabolic potential. Typical numbers for our trap is a frequency of the light near 1 micron with a D1 transition wavelength of 599 nanometers. So we are pretty far detuned. The typical numbers for our trap are listed here. So we operate this trap at pretty low powers, like only 5 to 50 milliwatts. The trap depth we can achieve, the typical size we apply, is something like 1 to 10 microkelvin. A typical size is 5 to 15 micrometer, which is of the order of the size of a magnetically trapped condensate. And actually, we have a much larger size. It goes until a millimeter, actually, so there's a large aspect ratio. The trapping frequencies in this trap are pretty high radially, actually, and Wolfgang already pointed out that this optical trap, which in his talk was creating this dimple in the potential, compresses atoms. So we have high radial scattering frequencies and high density in our optical trap. Here's a schematic of how we load our optical trap. We start with a magnetically trapped Bose-Einstein condensate, which is just kind of standard means condensed by optical cooling methods, followed by evaporative cooling. So we have already a condensate, which is small and fits into our small trapping volume of the optical trap. Down here, I just showed a schematic what the field values or the light powers are, just for illustration. So we start with a magnetically trapped cloud, and we ramp up the light field. We just focus our far rectitude light just into the magnetically trapped condensate. And then we just suddenly switch off our magnetic trapping field. So we leave the condensate confined now only in the Gaussian beam. In some experiments, we need to increase the optical confinement in the Z direction, so we can put some bluetitude end caps, which are repulsive and confine the atoms in the axial direction. Now we already have the freedom to flip the spins or to apply external magnetic fields. This is indicated here. We can, just by applying a RF frequency, we can flip the spins in the trap. And for example, for the Feshbach resonance study, we can apply a strong bias field. And at the moment available is a bias field of up to 2,000 Gauss. For imaging, we of course can image by non-destructive phase contrast methods, but it turned out to be for a quantitative analysis of the clouds, it turned to be better to suddenly switch off the field in the order of several microseconds, switch off all fields, the magnetic bias field and the light field, let the cloud expand in free space and do some imaging in time of flight, some absorptive imaging. In this sequence of pictures, phase contrast images of a purely magnetically trapped cloud is shown. Here we overlap our focus IR beam and the magnetically trapped cloud. And here we leave the atoms only hold in the optical trap. Just gives you an impression of size of our trap. So this optical trap has a pretty long aspect ratio, and the cloud looks like a spaghetti, more or less. In this sequence of pictures, I show you time of flight pictures. 45 milliseconds time of flight of an originally magnetically trapped cloud, and in the last that picture here, a time of flight picture of an optically trapped cloud. What you can see, there are some excitations. These are just due to this sudden switch on of the optical field and sudden switch off of the magnetic field. These excitations, which occur here, typically damp out after a time of 1 second or 1.5 seconds or so. But also you can see that these clouds, that this cloud is larger than that. And the size of such a time of flight picture reflects the mean field energy of the trapped cloud, which is proportional to the density. So we can already here, by a quick look, tell that the density in our optical trap is significantly higher than the density in the magnetically trapped cloud. And here is just another picture of the optically trapped cloud without any time of flight. The transfer from the magnetic trap to the optical trap is dependent on how much power we put into the optical trap. Of course, there is a minimum power required to load atoms into this optical trap. It's a 5 milliwatt, for example. Here I show you the fraction of the atoms in blue which are confined, which are held in the optical trap, starts with small values at roughly a power of 10 milliwatts. We reach a maximum, and we can transfer something like between 80 or 90% of all magnetically trapped atoms into the optical trap. If you go to higher power, however, we do not reach 100%. We already compress the atoms so strongly that the density is so high and the free body losses become important that already in the stage where we ramp up the optical trap, the free body recombination losses become important. So the number of trapped atoms decreases again. and in yellow is a fraction of the lost atoms indicated. An important characterization of a trapped condensate is what's the lifetime, and this tells you what experiments you can do with such a trap and such a cloud. And I've just listed here the different sources of losses in this differential equation, which is the rate of losses per atom. Of course, there are collisions with ref gas or radio scattering due to the optical field. These are one-body losses, which is characterized by a K1 constant. There are two-body losses, like dipolar relaxation or evaporative cooling, is also dipolar loss in some sense. And there are the three-body recombination losses. The dipolar is proportional to a density. The three-body is proportional to a density squared. If the density was a constant in during the loss process, we would see just an exponential decay curve. But as we lose atoms, we decrease density. So the losses due to free-body recombination are suppressed more and more if you go to lower densities or lose more atoms. So by measuring the loss curves out of this trap, we can distinguish between the different loss processes. And such curves are shown here. The bright blue curves are just a plot of the number of atoms which are confined as a function of a dwell time in the trap. And we see in this magnetic trap we reach typical lifetimes of 20, 30 seconds or so. In the optical trap, the lifetimes are shorter, just simply because the density is higher, the three-body recombination losses are higher. And that's, of course, dependent on the optical power or the confinement we choose. But you can see here, lifetimes of the weakest trap are pretty long, are comparable in the order of magnitude with the magnetic trap. The atoms go in the several seconds region. If we increase the power, we have smaller lifetimes with the highest powers and the highest densities start here. We have lifetimes of typically 100 milliseconds or something like that. You also see this maximum in transfer efficiency, which is not for the smallest powers, but something like 10 millivolts are necessary to really load something like 80-90% of all magnetically trapped atoms into the optical trap. This is a pretty old, but pretty old in the sense of 2 months or 3 months old plot. At the moment we are able to load something like 15 million atoms in the magnetic trap and transfer up to 10 million atoms in the optical trap. I mentioned the possibility to confine several spin states. We have demonstrated this by Stern-Gerlach experiment. What you see here is a cloud which was released from the optical trap and were allowed to have some time of flight. If we have no RF frequency to flip the spins, we just see some cloud. During this time of flight, a gradient magnetic field was applied. So the atoms experience some force depending on the spin orientation or the magnetic moment. If we now apply the RF sweep, we can show that the three spin states are separated here by this Stern-Gerlach experiment. So we have, in some sense, proven that nature is quantized, kind of. And we can confine all three spin states. The different brightness of these clouds reflect the density, but also reflect the fact that the absorption of the probe light, which is in our case polarized, is different just due to the different transition probabilities. So it does not truly reflect how many atoms we have here in the cloud. It's possible by choosing the right RF frequencies and the right magnetic fields to not widely distribute the atoms in the different spin state, but we can really select different spin states and put really close to 100% of all atoms in each sublevel we like to study. With this result, I just like to point out what I mean with the new dimensions of the optical dipole trap. Of course, all studies we take, just as a general comment, can now be studied in arbitrary magnetic fields. Yeah, just as restricted. In some sense, we can talk of a new order parameter due to this spin degree of freedom. We change the symmetry from the U1 to the U1SO3. We can study spin waves. We can make use of the fact that the atoms which are in the MF equals plus 1 spin state are really in the absolute lowest spin state, so there is no dipolar loss possible anymore. If we study a two-component condensate, and we choose the MF plus and the zero component, there's no relaxation possible near conservation of total angular momentum, and there are no lower combination of spins that's possible for the atoms to relax into. And due to the fact that we can just select the spin state and put all atoms into, for example, the MF equals zero state, we can think of producing a machine which drives a typical clock transition, which goes from the capital F MF transition level to the capital F zero transition.
Why
which
is
I mean, if we have a conservation of angular momentum, and these are just the lowest lying levels, there's no energy gain in a different combination. And just it gives you an idea of what might be possible to study. We have taken pictures like that. It's not completely clear what we have imaged here, but it might indicate that a kind of spin dynamics is going on. I don't want to go too far and say there is some phase separation, but there is an idea of what might be observed if we go into more detail here. Excuse me? What I show is images like that. It's just again this Stern-Gerlach separation of three spin states. I mean, in general, you just expect something like that. You expect a typical time of flight picture out of a harmonic trap, which is has a density distribution which is also parabolic. And there is no reason for asymmetries like that, where the condensate is cut here and has a round shape here, because our potential.
What is the difference between different what parameters? What is the parameter?
I mean, these pictures were taken under not completely reproducible conditions. So these were RF sweeps which were not completely reproducible. We later on improved this situation and found conditions where we really reproducibly can put the atoms in different particular spin states. X stands for something, spin dynamic. Okay, let me come to my second part of the talk, the Feshbach resonances. I'm going to talk about the Feshbach resonances which we observed in the Bose condensed sodium system. In the meanwhile, Den Heinzen's group has also observed Feshbach resonances in not condensed rubidium sample by photoassociative spectroscopy. The Feshbach resonances are a way to change the scattering length A. We have we know that the Gauss-Peter-Yesky equation pretty nicely is a good description for condensates. especially for sodium, where we are definitely let's say it this way, that it really describes nicely all the properties of the condensate. I mean, the parameters which occur in this equation are the trap parameters. We can choose the trap parameters by choosing the trapping frequency, the volume, and this is accessible. The other parameter which occurs is the scattering length. And tuning the scattering length in the Feshbach resonance would give a complete control over all parameters which occur in this equation. So this might be good news for theorists that this equation can now be studied under various conditions. Okay, what's a Feshbach resonance? A Feshbach resonance occurs if we tune a molecular bound state or quasi-molecular bound state. If we tune this bound state cross zero, that means bound states are possible which have the same free component of the total angular momentum but have a different composition of the electron and nuclear spin. That means we have a different Zeeman shift compared to the collision channel. So we can relatively tune this bound state through zero, and the zero I mean that in this range of typical energies for bound state distances, the colliding atoms have zero energy. If I now tune this bound state from small or negative in respect to this zero in negative values, if I tune this bound state through zero to a positive values, the scattering length changes dispersively, and the scattering length first becomes large, in principle goes to infinity, and continues with a negative infinity and approaches again the off-resonance scattering length. It can be parameterized by such an equation, and can be a typical width delta B can assign to that. But of course, Feshbach resonance is not only changes elastic collisions, but also the inelastic collisions. So when we were starting to look for these resonances, we were expecting something like an increasing size of our clouds, but also to some losses. And what we observed was the following. This is a sequence of phase contrast images at different fields. So we ramped up our fields to high values and just ramped this field around 900 Gauss, and we saw a sudden loss of our signal. And note that the field range is only from 905 Gauss to 908 Gauss. So within less than a Gauss, we saw nearly all atoms disappear. We just switched over to the MF equals minus one, so this was for the MF equals plus one state, and we saw nothing like that. This graph just is a schematic of how our potential looked like. I don't want to go too much into detail here. So we had a closer look, more quantitative look, what happens in around 907 Gauss. And we did this now instead of phase contrast in absorption, and measured the number of atoms. And we found this quantitative curve of the number of atoms versus the field. So here is 907, here is 900 around. And we saw this extremely strong decrease of atoms. We saw the same if we approach the resonance from above. And you might like to ask how got the atoms up here if they all disappear if we approach the resonance. This was just by, instead of slowly going through this resonance, we just switch the field on, because typically it's 200 Gauss per millisecond ramp speed. So some atoms survived, and we could now approach this resonance with a little bit lower ramp speed, like 1 Gauss per millisecond, and we saw the same feature with loss of atoms. But of course, we are not interested in just loose atoms, so we wanted to have a look whether we can figure out what the scattering does. And this is shown here. The scattering length goes into the mean field energy, which is released in the time of flight picture, because if you switch off the field, the mean field energy is transformed into the kinetic energy. So the size of the cloud in time of flight reflects the mean field energy you have in your trap. And this mean field energy is a function of A, proportional to A. With some calculations, with some considerations, you can derive that the scattering length A is proportional to the root mean square velocity in time of flight to the fifth power divided by n, if you go from out of a parabolic trap. And this is just plotted here and is normalized to the off-resonance scattering length. And you see clearly the dispersive feature, and it's exactly like predicted. It goes to large positive values if we ramp, if we approach the resonance from lower values.
Not again
negative? You mean here?
Yes.
We couldn't approach this region because we lost too many atoms there. And exactly this is made us a little bit wonder why we lose so many atoms. So I have later on slides which illustrate and quantify these losses. We found, by the way, another resonance of the m equals plus 1 state, just 50 Gauss below. The resonance had the same feature, namely a strong loss of atoms. But this resonance seems to be much smaller than this broad resonance around 907 Gauss. We switched to the minus 1 atoms. The first picture I showed you indicated that in the region of up to 900 Gauss, the minus 1 atoms are not affected by any resonance. But if we ramp up to 1200 Gauss, we find a curve like that. It's again within a pretty small field range, like 1180 or so, going to 1200, we found a large, strong loss occurring. Plotting the same quantity, A, normalized to the off-resonance scattering length, we found that the resonance seems to be different. The scattering length goes first to smaller values. And if you look to the calculations from the Ferhaar group, you found that this was predicted. So instead of having such a crossing of a bound state, molecular bound state level through the resonance from below, you can just put it this way. And we find that if you Zeeman-detune a quasi-bound molecular state through the resonance through zero and come from larger values and crosses this direction, this resonance goes first to smaller values and finally negative if you do not lose too many atoms. Now we studied these strong losses a little bit more in detail. We just assumed that this can be described by three-body recombination losses. So we extracted out of our data the K3 coefficient, and we plotted this K3 coefficient versus the magnetic field. And remarkable in this plot is that the K3 coefficient pretty steeply increases if we approach the resonance. But it seems to do the same if we come from above, because the scattering length goes first to smaller values. I can plot the same data differently. I can plot these data against the scattering length. Just in arbitrary units, the off-resonance scattering length in my arbitrary units here would be around 64 or so. And these orange data plots correspond to this orange data. And it shows you like the K3 coefficient increases with the scattering length. And it shows you like it, this K3 increases also if you go to smaller scattering lengths. And this behavior can pretty nicely be approximated by a parabola, actually. Now, to get an idea by how much this K3 coefficient changes if you go, for example, from the off-resonance value to zero scattering lengths, or we go from the off-resonance scattering lengths to twice the scattering lengths, we must put some estimate of our trapping frequencies into the calculation, and then we can get a number. This number is, if you go to twice the scattering lengths or to zero scattering lengths, the K3 coefficient increases by roughly 750 with a large experimental uncertainty. So I could say it's something in between 500 to 1,000. So it's a very strong increase in the scattering lengths. And we address this loss processes by a different method. We ramped up our magnetic field with different speeds, and we crossed the resonance and just measured how many atoms survive after we have crossed the resonance by our B-field sweep. And we found for this smaller resonance, which is 50 Gauss below the larger resonance, that 30% survivors appear, we have 30% survivors if we have the inverse ramp speed of 400 microseconds per Gauss. At the larger resonance, we get 30% survivors if we have an inverse ramp speed of 1 microsecond per Gauss. This corresponds to 1,000 Gauss per millisecond ramp speed. And if we just say from our data from this plot of the scattering lengths that this resonance is 1 Gauss wide, this would correspond to the statement that in 1 microsecond we lose 70% of our atoms. So we really cross, if we cross this resonance, we have a pretty violent loss mechanism going on there. However, it's by far not clear that these data can be described by a classical free body loss mechanism. So because we cross the resonance, we essentially sweep over the extreme large positive and negative scattering lengths. So this might must certainly be differently described. Let me summarize in a form of a table what we have found, which resonances we have found. We have found two resonances for the MF equals plus 1 atoms, sodium, at 900 Gauss with a width of 1 Gauss. A smaller one, which is something like a factor of 100 or a little bit more smaller, at 853 Gauss. The resonances both tend to go to larger positive scattering lengths if we approach from below. And we found also a pretty strong resonance for the MF equals minus 1 system at around 1200 Gauss, which has the interesting feature that it goes first negative. And this feature is interesting because if we like to approach the 907 resonance from above to reach smaller scattering lengths, an interesting value would be zero scattering lengths, because we would leave the Thomas Fermi regime. Or if we like to go to even negative scattering lengths and study things like collapse with a large number of atoms, we are pretty much limited because we have to cross first two resonances to go into a field value higher than 907 Gauss and then approach it. So we are pretty much limited in the total number of atoms. But this resonance is the first one if we go from smaller field values, and we can now approach this resonance, which goes first negative, with billion atoms or so, if we ramp fast enough. Let me conclude here. The optical dipole trap is able to confine up to 10 million condensed sodium atoms, and lifetimes of seconds are achievable. Of course, with 10 million atoms, the density is so high that the lifetime is less than a second. The optical dipole trap confines all spin states and really opens the possibility to study a variety of spin-related effects in condensates. The optical dipole trap allows arbitrary magnetic fields experimentally available for us are at the moment 2,000 Gauss. We found three resonances I just talked about. We demonstrated that the scattering length changes dispersively around the resonance. And we found pretty much enhanced trap losses near these Feshbach resonances. And this enhanced trap losses are certainly an issue if we like to study these Feshbach resonances and condensates with different scattering lengths in more detail. And if it's a free body loss, the trap losses are proportional to density squared. So if we see that if we go to a scattering length zero, this K3 coefficient is something like a factor of 1,000 larger than the off-resonance K3 value, then we must reduce the density by something like a factor of 30 to get the same lifetime back again. And for going to even a negative scattering length, we certainly need to reduce the density even more. And this is, this is part of our future projects. So thank you.
Instead, put an inhomogeneous field where the value of the field range my time up.
Yeah, it's going to go up from far.
Excuse me. Range over the range, like say from 900 Gauss to 910 Gauss. Do you think it's possible that you might be able to say eat holes in the in parts of the condensate?
In principle, it should be possible that we kind of reach this resonance not only at different times we set with our imaging, with our ramp speed, but also in a not uniform, a spatial uniform way. That's certainly true.
Okay. More engineering confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about smaller field values. I mean, we found we found the resonance to be pretty small. I mean, it's a Gauss wide, so we must talk about smaller, definitely smaller field gradients to achieve that. Yeah, that this graph shows a theoretical calculation of Feshbach resonances done by Frank van Abelen at the Eindhoven group. maybe we concentrate on the MF equals plus 1. In red, the threshold, that means the zero energy of the colliding channel is shown as the independence of the external magnetic field. And you see here two bound state levels having a different Zeeman shift crossing the crossing the zero energy at something like in between 800 and 1,000 Gauss. We found it at 907. So the predictions are pretty accurate actually. And when we planned our Feschbach resonance project, we expect plus one resonance between 800 and 1,000 Gauss. So we were thinking about, okay, how can we achieve such a high field with our power supplies, with our coil set? And we found that if we drive our coil set in the right way, it's achievable. So this was known. And
no, I read that, but I'm curious how close exactly were
the uncertainties which the Eindhoven group gave was something like in between 800 and 1,000 Gauss, because you might be able to really relatively precisely tell what the difference in field between these two resonances is, but the total set of lines have some positive uncertainty in the total height. And if you shift two lines which are under some small angle intersecting, and you have some uncertainty, you easily move the position of the resonances. And the typical errors they gave was it must be between 800 and 1,000 Gauss, something like that. Yeah, okay, first of all, we are in the lowest hyperfine state. So there is no dipolar loss in this sense. I mean, are you talking about if we are exactly at resonance and have zero energy released in putting these into the molecular state? Of course. This might be a process which is important if we sweep over the resonance, if we cross it. Like I have you shown these survivor plots, but we found that all our measurement points, are not at resonance, but are in a range of plus minus 0.5 Gauss around the resonance. And too much energy probably would be required. So we need a third a particle to explain these strong losses if we are a field value of 0.5 or 1 Gauss away and already see these strong losses.
May I ask you, I didn't understand one thing. Beta Pirates resonance. In past it was named Beta Pirates resonance. Why is not change of the sign of Ketter and Lenz? Because even if you have some inelastic addition in Ketter, I don't understand why it's not changed, because resonance must be accompanied just to change of the quantity of Ketter.
Yeah, I mean, we try to approach the resonance as much as we could from above to find this region where A goes to zero and negative. Yeah, we see it.
That's why you must have change of the time.
No, we only went to a little bit smaller scattering. Let me show you this plot again.
It never got far enough down to go negative. It was always just below the original value.
Yeah.
No, but for that it's not the additional, to have some potential better, which shift the situation in prison. Because this resonance by definition is the point of the change of the time of the
yeah.
length.
By some reason, I don't find just now my slide, which shows this dispersive change in scattering length.
We can talk.
Maybe we talk later. But the other plot I was showing to you is this one here. This might be sufficient to explain. Somehow I messed a little bit up with my slides here, so I can't find it at the moment. But we saw that the KSG recombination coefficient is so strongly increasing, even if we only a slight bit change the scattering length. And our densities are so high that the combination of this KSG coefficient plus our densities, which are in the order of 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15th per cubic centimeter, that the losses are so fast that we just lose all atoms before we can reach the magnetic field where the scattering length is negative or zero.
Okay, one more question.
Yes, you showed the measurement of the number of surviving atoms.
Yeah. Not yet. These data are only 1 week old. We have not yet really got the systematic variation of densities. This is certainly an interesting point. Does it go with density, linear or squared? What's the dependence? And this would help to explore the usefulness of such a resonance to make further measurements and studies.
One short question.
How long is what?
How accurate?
How accurate
do you know the confining potential in the optical track?
We can measure it, actually. We can induce a dipole oscillation in this cloud, for example, and can measure, for example, trapping frequencies. However, in our high field range, we have a pretty complicated potential. It was indicated in some of the early slides here. Bad luck. The problem is we do not have a completely a homogeneous bias field. This bias field has some curvature. And this curvature pushes the atoms in an axial direction. So we need to apply these blue-detuned end caps to confine the atoms in an axial direction, to just prevent them from leaving in that direction. So our total potential is a combination of the Gaussian beam potential, of the end caps, and of this field curvature. But in the time of flight pictures, you can, to some extent, judge over the parabolicity or whatever you like to call it. So in a first approximation, this potential is parabolic. Of course, if we increase the chemical potential, if we fill this potential to higher values, then of course we must correct for that. That this is not a parabolic potential. That's completely true.
Okay. Thank you very much.